So, our second topic, and the one that hopefully we really will wrap up today, is the topic of healthcare costs. At any rate, this is an easier one to discuss in the sense that we'll see. Let me not say it's easier until it actually turns out to be easier. This case resembles the cosmetic surgery discussion in terms of its structure. Meaning, when we talked about abortion, so we had clear biblical texts to work from, and the job of the rabbis was to figure out how to apply them. So I had texts that talked about if one kills a fetus, one pays a penalty, doesn't say murder. We had to figure out how to understand that, how to apply it, but fundamentally you're working from biblical text that addresses the legal issue. When we dealt with cosmetic surgery, on the other hand, we had no clear biblical legal commands that helped us out. We did have the law of stay away from harming yourself, don't harm yourself, but that was really about it. Other than that, we have biblical ethics to work with. And the same thing is largely true in the topic of healthcare costs. The issue that I want to address is this. What are the ethical issues involved in charging people to heal them? What would you say the ethical issues are in charging people in order to heal them? Right? People who don't have means are not going to get treated. I'm framing it in the negative, but it's the same, I think it's roughly the same point. Etty? Yeah? The doctor has to make a living also. See how many doctors you're going to have if you tell them that you can't charge. Stephen? That was it. Marilyn?
The same thing. Medical professionals have families and have to make a living. So that's...
Right. Okay, yes?
Some people in that, isn't there an injunction to heal and save a life? So perhaps it shouldn't be charged?
Right. So these are our basic issues, right? I'm going to frame them slightly differently, but basically encompassing what's been said, maybe expanding a little bit. Number one, there's a duty to heal, which we're going to talk about this morning. There's a duty to heal. And if there's a duty to heal, then I should have to do that. If I have the capacity to heal, I should have to carry that out. I should have to act on it. That's number one. And that would be whether I'm being paid to do so or not. Second, shouldn't the doctor be able to look out for herself and to say, I need to be able to feed my family, I need to be able to live, how can you tell me that this is now my responsibility? It's one thing to say for other mitzvot, which don't necessarily dominate a person's entire life, that you have responsibility to do it even if you're not going to get paid. So for example, there's a mitzvah that says, we're going to come back to it shortly, you have to restore people's lost property. Right? I'm walking down the street and I see a wallet, I open it up, I see an identification, I have a responsibility to return it to its owner. That's fairly straightforward. And I can't take money, right? I mean, there's some discussion, what if I have to lose time from work in order to do it? That's an interesting technical discussion. But basically, I don't take money, I knock on the person's door, I even put it in the mail to send it back to them, whatever it is, I restore their property to them. But would you now tell me that I have to spend all day looking for people's lost property and giving it back to them and not taking payment for it? Because that's essentially what we're asking of the physician. Since there's a duty to heal, that's what you're going to have to do all day long, and you can't take payment for it. Not to mention, along with that, can society expect to have medical professionals if it's not willing to pay them? The easy answer is no. That's, I think, fairly straightforward. I gave a longer class on this a while back, and in source number 7 I gave you a link for anyone who wants to hear the longer discussion of this. But what I want to do today is just see what the issues are and how we've dealt with the different imperatives that are involved. So, first of all, to anchor... Yeah, Ian.
What about your enemy?
What about your enemy? What about healing your enemy? Is that really different? No, I'm asking you. You know, the Torah is very funny. The Torah talks about the obligation called in Hebrew prika uti'ina. What it means is, if I see somebody else's animal is struggling under a burden, I am obligated to remove the burden from the animal, to help him unload the animal. If he is trying to load the animal and he's having difficulty, I am obligated to help him load the animal. The Torah presents it twice. But what's interesting is, in one case, it presents it in terms of your friend's animal. In the other case, it presents it, right? In the other case, it presents it in terms of your enemy. So the Talmud asks, which one has priority? If you have an option to help your enemy's animal or your friend's animal. It's a little more complicated than that, but I don't want to get into the complication of it. But the answer in the Talmud is, help the enemy first. Because that has the added benefit of bringing yourself under control. So the answer is the enemy gets helped first. Now, that leads to another question about, well, what if it's an enemy who wants to kill you and helping the neutralized terrorist? Which, again, I can send you a link. We've been down that road. But in terms of the ethical issues that are involved here, first of all, the duty to heal. Take a look, please, at source number 8. Source number 8 is one of several verses which teach that there is a duty to heal others. And I'm bringing you a series of verses to show just how important this is within Judaism, just how many biblical imperatives you have. Number one, you shall not stand by as the blood of your peer is shed. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, from which the Talmud learns, if I see somebody else is in trouble, somebody else is in danger of being harmed, I have a responsibility to step in order to help. That's one. Number two, take a look at source number 9. This is a tzedakah imperative, financial aid. Should your brother become poor with you, you shall hold on to him. The stranger, the resident, it's not just your brother, and he shall live with you. Do not take interest from him, and you shall revere Hashem your God, and the life of your brother shall be with you. That last set of words, the life of your brother shall be with you, in Hebrew, v'chei achicha imach. His life shall be with you, teaches an obligation to ensure that this person is able to live alongside you. Another verse, more famous, source number 10, we referred to it earlier. Ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you shall love your peer as yourself. I always struggle with translating rea in Hebrew, your peer, your neighbor. It's meant to connote some level of association. So I did peer there, you can rewrite it as neighbor if you like. The next one, source number 11. This is the obligation I mentioned earlier of restoring lost property. It shall be with you, this is your neighbor's animal, it shall be with you until your brother seeks it, and you shall restore it to him. All of these are obligations, and the truth of the matter is there are more that you can bring, but this demonstrates the responsibility that we have to look after the welfare of others, and that includes healing them. Next step. As a general rule, we believe that one should fulfill one's obligations without looking for enrichment. One is not supposed to try to become wealthy when doing mitzvot, or to be rewarded for doing mitzvot. Take a look at source number 12. Here's an example of of this point. This is from the story of Korach. Remember that Moses is a Levi. His brother Aaron is the first Kohen, the first priest. He and his kids will do the work in the Mishkan. Now, Moshe is part of a larger family, meaning, let's start from the top of the family, that's easier. One of the sons of Yaakov and Leah was Levi. Levi has three sons, Gershon, Kehat, and Merari. Kehat has four sons, Amram, Yitzhar, Hebron, and Uziel. So you're now the third generation. Amram has two sons and a daughter, right? He has Miriam, Aharon, and Moshe. The reason I'm walking you through this is the following. That whole family, meaning the descendants of Levi, his three sons and all of those who descend from them, are all Levian. Only one slim branch there becomes Kohanim, right? Out of Levi's three sons, so that's already splitting the family roughly in thirds, then only one of them, and from him, he has four sons, So only one of those is Amram. And from Amram, it's only Aaron. So there are way fewer Kohanim than there are Levim. Interestingly, though, if you look around in the synagogue, you will always find more Kohanim than Levim. Because it was never a big thing for someone to say, I'm a Levi. And therefore, a lot of people just lost track of that within their family line. One might suspect there were also people who moved to a community where they weren't known and said, yeah, I'm a Kohen. There wasn't an incentive to say, I'm a Levi. But the bottom line is, we've ended up with more Kohanim than Levim in our communities, but genetically, it really ought not to be so. You really should have way more Levim. Well, one of those Levim is a man by the name of Korach. And he says, Moshe, you and your family are getting rich off of this Mishkan, the tabernacle that the Jews have, because your brother gets to be the Kohen, and his kids get to be the Kohanim. That means they get portions from the offerings. That means they get special tithes. Levim do also, but not to the extent that the Kohanim do. So he makes the argument in source number 2, and they, Korach and his family, gathered upon Moshe and upon Aaron, and they said to them, you have much. The entire community is holy, and God is in their midst. Why do you elevate yourselves above the nation of God? He would be right, except he's talking to Moshe. And generally speaking, Moshe is not somebody who's looking to aggrandize himself. What he's doing is because God told him to. But the claim is, you are enriching yourselves through religious activity. You're not supposed to get rich off of fulfillment of a duty. And in fact, generations later, the claim would be correct. In the book of Samuel, source number 13, you find that the Mishkan, the tabernacle at this point, which is centuries after the story of Moshe and Korach, you find that the sanctuary is under the control of two brothers, Hophni and Pinchas. And indeed, they are taking advantage of it to enrich themselves. When people bring sacrifices, they say, well, we're taking the portion first. Even before you put any on the altar, we're going to take some for ourselves. And Eli, their father, is criticized for allowing them to continue to serve. In source number 13, a prophet comes with a message from God for Eli, saying, why do you kick my sacrifice and my gift, which I commanded for the sanctuary? You have honored your sons before my nation more than me, fattening yourselves from the first of the gifts of Israel. You're not supposed to get rich off of fulfilling your duties. So much so that in source number 14, the prophet Samuel has been leading the Jews, doing an excellent job, and doing it very selflessly. But they come to him and say, we'd like to have a king. And Samuel feels the need to justify himself to them. And he says, in source number 14, he says, here I am. Answer me before God and before his anointed one. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Who have I cheated? Who have I urged? Meaning urged to give me something. From whom have I taken payment to ignore his actions? Tell me and I will refund it. He says, I've taken nothing from anybody. He feels the need to say so because we have a sense within Judaism that you can't, again, enrich yourself by fulfilling your duties. And one last source to support this, source number 15. This is when Moses is told to find judges to lead the people. So the specifications are that he should identify from the entire nation, Anshei Chayil, men of substance, who are Yirei Elokim, God-fearing, Anshei Emet, men of truth, and Sonei Batza, haters of prophets. They should be people who aren't looking to make a buck. That's what Moshe is told to look for in the judges. So what I'm trying to build here, and there are many more sources you could bring to this effect, but is that you're not supposed to look for enrichment from fulfilling your duty. And if your duty is to look after other people, if that's a religious duty, which we spelled out in various verses, then the doctor should not be able to take payment. Except, as we said, there's a flip side. There has to be a flip side, because otherwise you won't have any doctors. And even though it's true that the Torah's ethics tend to set up a high bar, they tend to set up high expectations, nonetheless, they tend to be bounded by practical reality. So for example, in one of the biblical verses instructing us to give tzedakah, take a look at source number 16. We are told, the pauper will never disappear from the midst of the land, therefore I instruct you, open your hand to your brother, your pauper, your indigent person in your land. Did you notice how the verse began? The pauper will never disappear from the land. Never expect that your nonprofit is going to run in the black. It doesn't work that way. There will always be more needs to fill. There will always be people to take care of. And if you're running in the black, it means you're not doing a good job. It means that you didn't identify all the needs and actually use your ability to take care of them. That's the statement that we're getting in number 16. It's, you have to be a realist. And therefore, even though we've just said that the Levites aren't supposed to enrich themselves and the priests, the Kohanim, are not to enrich themselves, nonetheless, take a look at source number 17. God says, I'm not going to have priests otherwise if I don't give them something. The choicest oil, the choicest wine and grain, the first of them, which they shall give to God, God says, I have given to you, meaning to the priests. So they do receive something for what they serve. And indeed, when it comes to medical practice, last source in this section, number 18, we're told that if one person harms another, he has to pay that person's medical bills. Pay for time lost from work, certain other payments which aren't stipulated in his sentence, but also, to heal him, he has to pay the person's medical bills. Well, that means that it's recognized that there is such a thing as paying for medicine. I rushed through this a little bit so far. Are we clear on what we're saying here? Right? Without a doubt, you have an ethic that says, don't enrich yourself off of fulfillment of religious duty, which will include healing others. At the same time, there's a certain realism that says there has to be some form of payment. As a matter of fact, the Talmud has this funny line regarding the issue of hiring a doctor to heal the person you've harmed. And ask the question, what if the person who harmed somebody else has a brother who's a doctor? And he says he'll do it for free. Is he allowed to say to the victim, my brother is going to be the physician, and that way I don't have to pay anything? The Talmud's answer is no. You can't do that. Why? Because it says, a doctor who heals for nothing is worth nothing. That's the Talmud's observation. I'm not kidding. That's a word-for-word quote. So you can't say that. You have to recognize there has to be some kind of payment. Marlene?
The flip side, it doesn't apply in Canada necessarily, but in the States, where medical care costs can be so exorbitant that people can't afford to pay for it, to heal themselves.
I have news for you. That's here also. Yeah. It's just not a...
No,
socialized medicine takes care of a lot, but... Yeah.
Okay, so where does that go?
So that's going to be part of our discussion as well. We're going to talk about that also. So we're getting there. The question was, what happens if somebody can't afford it? So the basic rabbinic analysis of this leads them to say that, number one, one really shouldn't be able to charge. That it is a duty, and therefore one shouldn't be able to charge. So for example, take a look at source number 19, where the sages talk about taking vows. Vows were a lot more popular in Talmudic times than they are today. I don't see a lot of people taking so many vows today, and that's a good thing. The biblical text does not approve in general of making promises. You never know what's going to come up and whether you'll be able to keep them. But in the event that there are two people who are in some kind of a fight, and one of them vows, I am not going to benefit that other person. That person is not allowed to benefit from me at all. That's the case that they're talking about. So in number 19, we are told, one who is not permitted to benefit another due to a vow. If somebody, in fact, has sworn off, you're not allowed to benefit from me, he's still permitted to heal him. Not to heal his property, his animals, but to heal him. In other words, if I take a vow that I'm not going to help somebody else, I'm still allowed to be his doctor. Why is that? Nope. Not about saving a life. It's not necessarily a life and death case. Why am I still allowed to be his doctor? Because I have a duty to heal that precedes my vow. My first vow, so to speak, is made at Mount Sinai to keep the Torah. I have an obligation to heal. Therefore, I can't say to him that I refuse. I'm not entitled to refuse. And based on that, the principle is that I also am not allowed to demand payment. I brought you an example of this in the Talmud in source number 20 regarding teaching Torah. God says to Moses, I taught you for free. Therefore, you have to teach the children of Israel for free. You're not allowed to charge people in order to teach them Torah. Don't worry, there are plenty of ways that that rabbis can make a living without having to do that. We'll get to it in another couple of minutes. But the basic principle is, you have a duty, you're not allowed to charge for it. So much so, there's a line in the Talmud at the end of the volume called Kiddushin, in which the rabbis make observations about various professions. And the observation about doctors, anyone know what they have to say about doctors? Anybody ever hear this?
All good things?
Not exactly. The line about doctors, anyone familiar with this? Yes. Yeah. I won't take that personally. But the statement is, Tov sheberofim legehinom. Which means the best of the doctors go to hell. That's the line. To which all the commentators ask, what in the world are you talking about? It's not good to be the best doctor? Is that the lesson? So there are various explanations that are given, unsurprisingly. But take a look at source number 21, where Rashi comments and explains. He says there are a few reasons for this. He says, this doctor does not subdue his heart before God. He says, first of all, because when you get that good, unfortunately, that can bring arrogance. That's one concern. Number two, sometimes he kills. Meaning, sometimes when you're that confident in your abilities, you get careless. And that's a second concern. Sorry? This is also true. This is also true. He's trying to explain the text and say what motivated them to say this. Because generally speaking, Talmudic teaching loves doctors. Where did this come from? So first, his first statement is maybe there's an issue of arrogance. His second statement is maybe because there's an issue of carelessness that creeps in. But his third one is the one that's germane for us. He is able to heal the poor, but he doesn't. In other words, because he's the top doctor out there, he has plenty of people coming to him, and he says, okay, if you can pay me, then I'll do it. Otherwise, I'm not interested. And so what this text is doing is it's warning of pitfalls. That's really the goal of this text about doctors. And what it's saying is, you should know there are risks involved. If you become a physician, there's a risk that you say, I am wonderful, and you become arrogant as a result because you can see the impact on other people and you see the gratitude that they feel and that they express. And that can build you up in a way that is in the end harmful. Number two, it's a warning, another pitfall, carelessness when you're dealing with health issues. And number three, the warning that if they decide that they're going to turn down people who can't afford it, and that goes back to Marlene's question, as the warning goes, Tov sheberofim, the best doctor, ends up, for all of the righteousness and for all the things that the doctor did, still ends up in Gehinnom as a result, has to be punished as a result. Other reads of this line, just because I saw a couple of hands, I don't want to shortchange people. Shauna.
So there's also the idea that it's God that decides like if we'll be healed or not, and that the doctor is more of the messenger, the go-between. So the idea of, in terms of the arrogance, like if the doctor thinks that I'm the one who healed this person, I did everything, like there's no peace in there.
Right, and that would be part of the concern for arrogance would be not only in terms of one's relation with others, but also in terms of one's relation with God. This is true. Although one is never supposed to say, so therefore I'm not going to heal, because let God take care of it.
No.
Yes.
There's a book called The God Complex. Yes. Which is given to graduating medical students. And it's about how
that
it's not a religious book.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Marlene points out the existence of a book in paperback, the God Complex, and she says that it's given out, I don't know if this is done universally, but that it's given to graduating medical students. I mean, look, this is a risk in every field, right? I mean, this is a risk in every field. And, you know, clergy are certainly vulnerable to the same level of arrogance. But I think in particular, when you're dealing with a practice in which you are managing life and death, and you are helping people to survive things that otherwise they couldn't, yes, there is a level of risk that you won't find for, you know, pick a random other profession, I don't want to offend anybody, so pick it yourself, where you don't see the same kind of impact on people and the same kind of gratitude from people. That's the reality. Brenda.
Isn't it, going back to your enemy, in Israel every day they are in hospitals, they are working with Israelis and enemies side by side.
Mm-hmm. Right, no, this is true. I mean, I'm going to be careful to distinguish between Arab and enemy, because I don't want to... I know that's not what... I heard the word. I just want to make sure that it's understood what we're saying. But yes, this is a very difficult issue, but it's beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss right now. The issue of, is there a point at which you say, I'm not willing to treat, but I'm gonna go back to the issue here of the doctors and charging. Because what we're talking about here is a duty, there is an understanding that one who refuses is, yeah, not criminal, that's too strong a word, but is violating their biblical obligation. They're violating their mitzvah. But if you stop there, then again, so where do you get doctors? Where do you get people in general to fulfill their mitzvot? So the rabbis found other ways in which doctors are able to charge. Take a look at source number 22, please. We're going to see three ways in which they justified charging. Number one, and I'm bringing you this here in source number 22 from Rabbi Moses ben Nachman, also known as Ramban, is to say, not everything a doctor does is the very narrow, specific act of healing. He says, regarding wages for healing, it seems to me that one may take payment for time lost and strain, but not for teaching. What he means by teaching, he means teaching the patient what to do. So giving advice to the patient is not something you can charge for. However, there's a lot of time lost and strain. And what he means when he says time lost is go back in time. As I noted on the sheet, he's writing in 13th century Spain. You had many people in that time, and frankly, until almost modern times, who were doctors on the side. It wasn't their living. It wasn't what they dedicated their whole existence to. So they would, at times, heal people, and whatever healing meant in different eras, but they could be a barber and a bloodletter. They could, you know, have a business and also be involved in dispensing ointments and herbs or whatever it was. So whatever time the doctor is using to see patients is time that the doctor is not using for their other way of making a living. So you can charge the patient and say, this is an hour that I could have spent day trading, so now I'm going to charge you based on what I could have earned day trading. And even if you'll say, well, today that's not the way it works, because people, you know, spend their lives as physicians, and it's not just physicians, I mean, we apply this to other medical professionals, nurses, and so on, the argument is still, they could have pursued a different livelihood. And what we're paying them for is not pursuing whatever else they could have done that would have earned them money, as well as, one second, as well as the strain that is involved. Meaning, it's hard work. It's hard work in terms of psychological tension that you have to deal with when this kind of burden is on your shoulders. It's hard work in terms of keeping up on the field, reading the journals, studying what's going on, improving one's technique, depending again on what type of medicine one is practicing. But you're paying for all the strain that went into the doctor being able to heal the patient right now. So the doctor can't say, I want you to pay me for the 15 minutes that I'm going to spend diagnosing and talking to you, but the doctor can say, for the fact that I went into medicine altogether, the fact that I put in the work such that I am able to diagnose, that's something that you're still able to charge for, says Ramban, and in the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 23, that is codified as indeed Jewish law. A doctor may not take payment for conveying knowledge and teaching patients, but he may take payment for strain and time lost from other remunerative pursuits. Ruth?
What you dealt with, I put my hand up, is what I was going to say. In modern times, the education that the doctor has removes him from making a living elsewhere.
Right.
So that would be a reason for reimbursement.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely true. So that's one argument to justify charging. Second argument to justify charging. Yeah. Sorry, I wrote it.
I have kind of a problem with the idea of not being paid for teaching in preventative medicine.
Meaning?
Meaning that they can't charge for spending time discussing the patient's illness.
Because again, it's their duty to discuss that. You can't charge for fulfilling your obligation, but you're able to charge for putting yourself in a position to do that. Let me frame this a little bit differently. I think it'll make it a little more clear. The fact that there's a duty to heal, does that mean that there's a duty for all of us to go out and get medical training so that we'll be able to heal? Do you have an obligation? Does every Jew have an obligation to go to medical school? Ask their mother. Realistically, why don't you make that argument that you have a duty to enroll in medical school so that you will be able to heal others? And the answer is, the obligation is on the person who's in that position to offer the help. It's a good thing to do, but it's not an obligation. In the same way, I have an obligation to give tzedakah. Do I have an obligation, therefore, to spend extra hours working in order to earn money so that I will be in a position to give tzedakah? The answer is no. The answer is it may be a good thing to do, but the obligation is if you have the funds, then help people. If you have the medical knowledge, then help people. But the exertion involved in gaining that knowledge, that's something you can say, I should be compensated for. But that's all one argument. The second argument is capitalism. This is what the market will bear. If someone is willing to pay it, so I'm willing to take it. Take a look at source number 24. He's talking about, again, a doctor charging. And he says, the doctor, stipulated it. This is a commentary on the Code of Jewish Law. And the patient obligated himself to pay. And the mitzvah is not only incumbent upon this doctor, but anyone could train in medicine. His argument is, I chose to become a doctor, others chose to be doctors, you could have gone to me, you could have gone to somebody else. If this person comes to me and wants me to take care of them, then they say to me, I want to pay you to do it. So it's fine for me to accept it. There's nothing wrong with me accepting that which others are willing to pay. And then the third argument is the society argument to say society needs doctors. And therefore, even if you'll tell me a doctor is not allowed to charge, society is allowed to determine that this is a need. And on that basis, they're able to institute payments. So take a look at source number 25, which is a general statement about what a community can do under social contract. Townspeople may make rules for measures and prices and wages and may fine those who violate the norms. The city can decide, or in Canada's case, the province can decide, we are going to provide medical treatment for people, we're going to take their tax dollars, and we're going to use it to create a socialized medicine system. That's what you're seeing here, and that's the third argument for doctors to be able to charge. It's society saying we need to make sure there are doctors. Now, I say I have 5 minutes to go, and I really want to finish the topic, so I'm going to stop questions at this point. In order to stress the following. The balancing act is not only regarding the issue of paying doctors. It comes up on the other side in terms of strikes. Are medical personnel allowed to go on strike? So I get a bunch of people saying no, because it's an essential service, but this is actually hotly debated in Jewish law. It came up in Israel a few times, most notable in the early 80s, when there was a lot of rabbinic writing about a physician strike that went on in the hospitals in Israel. A lot of back and forth. Take a look at source 26, Rabbi J. David Bleich, in an article called Physician Strikes. An interesting point regarding the level of services which must be provided is reflected in a letter addressed to the medical staff of Shaare Tzedek Hospital, signed by two leading rabbinic authorities and published in the Kislev 5744 issue of Asiya, the end of 1983. The signatories Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss, Mincha Yitzchak, we mentioned him last week, 2 weeks ago, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, report that it had come to their attention that the number of physicians available to treat patients fell below the number of physicians customarily on duty on Shabbat. Assuming that the Shabbat staff is the minimum necessary for purposes of pikuach nefesh, of saving lives, those authorities declare that the members of the medical staff are obligated to assure the presence of medical personnel, quote, not fewer in number than on the holy Sabbath days. In other words, you have to make sure you have staffing necessary to save lives. Push off the elective surgeries, the things that can wait, but at least the staffing level needed in order to save lives. There's also another point that's made in the article. They're not allowed to do things that will keep them from treating patients properly. Meaning that if there's discussion of a hunger strike, as an example, you can't do that. Because then if you do see a patient, you're going to be too weak to take care of the patient properly. But the point made in the article and the issue that they were dealing with, they were struggling with is, on the one hand, the doctor needs to be able to charge for those things the doctor is allowed to charge for. On the other hand, we have a duty to heal. So we try to balance it by saying, make sure you can provide life or death care. Parenthetically, I'm sure you all know this, we may even have mentioned it at some point, you know that during strikes, generally speaking, the mortality rate in hospitals drops. Right. But it's not what it sounds like. It drops because all the elective procedures are all pushed off. That's why. Last note. Given that healing is a mitzvah, and given that we have such mixed feelings about charging, is a doctor allowed to take a vacation? Is a doctor allowed to say, I know I have doctor's presence, is a doctor allowed to say, it's 11 o'clock at night, I really don't want to answer the phone because I know what this is. This is someone who has my home number. You know, it's Shabbos afternoon. This is somebody knocking on my door who wants some kind of help. Am I obligated to answer the door? Am I obligated to answer the call? Dr. Fred Rosner in source number 27 dealt with this and he wasn't sure. However, various arguments are brought to justify the vacation, not to worry, or to justify having specific hours when you will answer the phone. I'm going to cut this a little bit brief, but first of all, it makes you a better doctor, meaning you can't see people constantly and not have that lead to deterioration. You need the opportunity to breathe. That's number one. Number two, there are other doctors who are available, generally speaking, while you're on vacation. That's source number 28, Rabbi Yosef Shalom Yashiv says, you know what, there are other people who can get called. You can say, this is my meal time right now. This is when I'm lying down. I'm not able to answer this right now. It is true that if you're in a life and death situation, all bets are off. And so for doctors working in certain fields, they may have a problem. Because you can't turn away somebody where that means you're sending that person to die any more than anyone is able to turn away someone in that circumstance. But barring that, the doctor, it would seem, is indeed entitled to say, I need to declare that at certain hours I'm not available. I need to be able to go away. Last bit. What would Judaism say of a socialized medicine system? So already we said the passage in the Talmud that the community is able to decide these are what wages are and this is what we're providing. They're all able to collect funds from people and so on. The community can set up whatever it likes. But you should note there's a flip side, and this is something that doctors always ask about. I've heard this question any number of times. What would Judaism say about sunshine laws? The ones where they can publish in the newspaper the salaries of the highest earning, or however many highest earning physicians or medical professionals are out there. So as a basic principle in Judaism, we oppose what's called rechilut, tail-bearing. We oppose publication of other people's private information. However, when you're dealing with communal funds, then indeed there is a need for a public accounting. So source number 29, I'm not going to read it out, is where the Code of Jewish Law talks about giving an accounting of how communal funds are spent. Mind you, I don't know that you need to publish doctors' names in order to achieve a communal public accounting. You could just as easily say, this amount is being spent in this way. You could even assign serial numbers of some kind to the doctors, where no one reading the newspaper is aware of what the name is associated with a particular number, and achieve the same result of public accounting without the embarrassment that's associated with it. So the argument that that the Sunshine rules are required, I think, is weak within Judaism, but certainly worth a conversation. I apologize for having to cut off questions in the last few minutes, but that's the basics of this topic. Next week, God willing, we get a full hour to discuss medical assistance in dying. For those who have further comments, I'll stick around for a few minutes, or as always, by email. If anyone needs to see me about either getting on the email list for the class or paying for it, I will be here again for the next few minutes to take care of that. Thank you very much.